Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to the program. My special guest today is Kathy Kelly, who has just returned from her eighth visit to Afghanistan. Kathy is a member of a group called Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who have steadily researched consequences of drone attacks, night raids and aerial bombings in Afghanistan. Risking imprisonment, they frequently protest US government plans to continue US military presence in Afghanistan until 2024 and beyond. Drawing from recent experiences living for months at a time in Afghanistan, Kathy Kelly frequently speaks and writes about perspectives of Afghan peace volunteers. They've told her and her companions their thoughts about prospects for their future in relation to NATO and the US 21st century military. Kathy previously lived alongside ordinary Iraqis whenever she and other Voices activists travelled there to break the US-UN economic sanctions against Iraq. They remained in Iraq throughout the shock and awe bombing of 2003 and during the initial months of the US occupation. Kathy Kelly, very much welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege to be on this program with you, Helen.
Now, so you were in Iraq during the shock and awe bombing in 2003, in the initial months of the US occupation. Would you like to talk about that first, Kathy?
Well, you know, the first 3 days, quite honestly, people were still out on the streets. Traffic hadn't lessened all that much. And I thought, well, it's going to take a lot more than this to shock and awe Iraqi people. They've seen so much already of bombing and economic sanctions. But on the end of day three, the United States Air Force unleashed everything it had, I think, in tandem with the Navy and with the other armed forces. There were ear-splitting blasts and sickening thuds and gut-wrenching explosions. So it just went on day and night. For the children, it was really terribly, terribly traumatizing. They would look to the faces of the adults, you know, to see, and if we didn't flinch, then, you know, they might go back to their game or their book. But, I guess maybe 2 weeks into it, little Dima had completely lost control of her bladder at 8 years of age. She'd be standing in a pool of her own urine and looking abject up at her father, apologetic, and the children, the littlest ones that I knew best, were by that time grinding their teeth morning, noon, and night. And you can just imagine the fear, the paralyzing fear for their mothers and the fathers who were away from their families and stayed at the hotel to keep it going were also just in a constant state of anxiety and panic for their families. And when the electricity was gone and nobody could be in touch, it was just a terrible, terrible punishment to people who meant no harm to the United States.
How long did it go on for, this shelling and thudding and bombing and explosions? How long?
Well, I think it started on March 15th, and then it was mid-April. And really, you couldn't say, well, then it ended, because ammunition dumps were being blown up, and so there would still be huge rackets. There were firefights that burst out unexpectedly. And then with no, what would you say, no administration, no enforcement of rules, no clarity, you know, who's in charge, Baghdad became utter chaos. And it would happen in my city of Chicago, too. Gangs, armed people just started roving around and saying, well, what are we waiting for, breaking windows and taking things? And, you know, these were people who'd been treated very, very badly all throughout the years of Saddam Hussein's reign and had been kept in dire poverty. Many of them were Shia neighborhoods, whole neighborhoods really were ready to rise up. And so the hospitals were filling up, and soon the kidnapping rates were rising, and people felt unsafe and anxious, and everybody seemed to want out, let me out. And do you know, there were no border controls. I went in and out several times in that stretch between April 2003 and, I don't know, maybe the middle of 2004. And one time I was going in with duffel bags filled with sheet music, but no one checked. You know, they could have been, they're huge duffel bags that could have been filled with weaponry or weapon parts. There were so many indignities heaped upon people in Iraq, so that now it's a broken, ravaged country, and corruption reigns in many levels of governance. So many of the professional trained classes that could run hospitals and schools and infrastructure have left. Of course, the one company that assuredly will make a huge gain is Halliburton, because they're really the only ones equipped to repair the oil processing and refinery machinery, which under the years of economic sanctions had completely gone to seed, more or less.
Yeah, it's terrible. I know. So they destroyed the electricity supply. They destroyed, and I wrote about that in my book, The New Nuclear Danger. They worked out that they had all these very fine sort of wire things, and if they dropped them over the transformer stations, the whole thing shorted out. And they did that on purpose. This is the Americans. They destroyed the sanitary system, the sewage system, so raw sewage was everywhere. And I followed it very carefully too, Kathy, but I wasn't there, that they used to burst into the hospitals and actually shoot the surgeons operating on a patient and shoot the patient on the operating table. That actually occurred too. And that many of my colleagues, doctors, were killed purposefully, and those that weren't fled because they were scared. So there are very few doctors now. And the sanctions are such that, they can't get drugs for the children and the like. I mean, you know all of this, but it's just obscene to me. Why the hell did America go in there in the first place? Clearly it went in because of the oil, wouldn't you say, Kathy?
Well, I think that the United States has wanted to control pricing and flow of oil, and I think the United States has also wanted to say to every other country in the world, if you don't submit to our demands, if you don't make your systems in your country subordinate to our national interests, we will eliminate your potential for a decent future for your children. And I think we've done it to Afghanistan. We've done it to Iraq. And this scares other countries. They take it very, very seriously.
But who the hell does America think it is? I'm sorry, but I have a huge degree of indignation about this. I mean, the guys that orchestrated this, Cheney and Rumsfeld, I mean, they've got kids. Have they got absolutely no feeling in their bones for other people and for children dying? I mean, it's beyond my imagination, Kathy. I suppose you felt like this.
Well, to top it all off, I think that following the Vietnam War, the very well-paid think tanks were told, find a way to assure that the Vietnam syndrome goes away. Mm. And the Vietnam syndrome was, I mean, you surely felt it too, an utter disgust with warfare. Nobody ever wanted to pursue another Vietnam. So there were almost formulaic decisions made. All right, the draft made that war very unpopular. We won't have a conscripted army. We'll have a backdoor draft. There will be so much impoverishment and desperation amongst young people who can't figure out a way to make their lives work. They'll join up. They'll sign up. They'll get perks, and they'll think that this is cool. Throw in a lot of movies that help to make that seem the case as well. And then there was a concerted effort to make sure that journalists couldn't act independently, that they would have to be embedded.
I love that term.
And then that there wouldn't be photos allowed of the dismemberment of United States soldiers in Afghanistan, or the body bags coming home, or the coffins coming back. And we really don't hear so much about the despair that many of the soldiers feel upon return. And then the third ingredient, and I've seen this work over and over again, is to convince people that it's a humanitarian war. And the soundbite was, well, we got rid of Saddam, didn't we? I mean, first you convinced the country, the United States, that only one person lives in Iraq, Saddam. And that way, 500,000 children dying under age 5, wretched, horrendous deaths because they couldn't get medicines and food and antibiotics and vitamins, convinced people that that didn't count, because really what was going down was the United States was going to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And then with Afghanistan, people think, well, we have to save the women and the children from the Taliban, don't we? And so you see another kind of almost level of indifference based on insecurity and doubt. People don't want to be harmful toward people in another country. So they somehow think that the United States war making is helpful. Now, all of that sounds like an oxymoron. It sounds like I'm crazy to even say those sentences. But this is what has been worked out, I think, by very well-paid think tanks. And
the media
United
goes
States
along
public,
with it.
Yes, the media does go along with it. There are some exceptions. I mean, you'll find some stories that are very, very admirable. The New York Times did a cover story on the wonderful work of the Italian emergency surgical centers for victims of war in Afghanistan. So that was one Sunday with a very fine and wonderfully photographed cover story. But just most recently, August 15th, the New York Times editorial suggested, it almost seemed to say that Afghan women should be grateful to the United States. Mm. And they don't mention that $2 billion is spent every week on the war, that $1 million is spent per year on each soldier. Well, I can tell you story after story of mothers, Shakira, Nakhbat, Safina. They come and they say, we think we're going mad. I can't feed my children. And I ask, well, what do you have for a meal at home? And they all, each one said, bread if we can get the flour or the wheat and tea without sugar.
Let's go back to Afghanistan in a minute. I just want to finish Iraq because I want to make the point that Saddam Hussein, since he was 21, was a CIA employee. He was an American stooge who did the bidding of America. And then when he, quotes, invaded Kuwait or tried to take oil from Kuwait, that's when America turned against him. But it was much more than that. And the other thing to note is that he was a Sunni, and people need to know of the internecine rivalries in this part of the world between various tribes, and they are kind of tribes. And so he's a Sunni. But as you talked about the Shias rising up when there was random chaos with the American bombing of Shock and Awe of Baghdad, so the Shias rose up because they'd been repressed for so long by Hussein. So people, it's important to know the background, and we could go on and on about Iraq. But then, Kathy, we'll move to Afghanistan now, because you're just talking about the women not able to feed their children when America is spending $2 billion a week on that blasted war. And what the hell does America think it's doing there? I don't even know why it's there, do you, Kathy? What are they trying to achieve when Hamid Karzai is, in fact, a stooge? He can't go outside Kabul because he's not liked by his people. He's corrupt as hell. America supports him. Can you try and explain what America thinks it's doing there, Kathy Kelly?
Well, Hamid Karzai was on the board of UNICAL in the 90s when that company was trying to build a pipeline. Mm. And the pipeline would bisect Afghanistan, cross through Pakistan, and go to India. And they couldn't build it. There was just not what they would call sufficient security to continue the construction, but the plans were never burned or thrown away. And I think that a main reason the United States wants to have as many as 450 forward operating bases in Afghanistan.
454?
Forward operating bases.
What is a forward operating base?
Well, it might be a little more than a berm and an outhouse, but they are ways in which the United States attempts to provide, let's say, security.
Colonize.
For future transportation projects like this pipeline.
Yeah.
Maybe I should also say that in the NATO summit that happened prior to the one in Chicago, this was in 2010 in Lisbon, Portugal, The Asia Development Bank agreed to underwrite the expenses for the construction of this pipeline. And the NATO countries, and particularly the United States, were exultant because this meant they could now build the pipeline. But they have to secure it, right? I mean, they don't want to put a lot of effort into building a stretch and then somebody blows it up. So I think this is why the United States wants to have a security network with drone surveillance and with special operations forces there until 2024 or beyond. The strategic partnership agreement that President Karzai and President Obama signed on May 1st, Obama went there in the middle of the night and signed it under the cover of darkness, will keep your Navy SEALs, Marine Rangers, Green Berets, and other special operations troops and mercenaries, the security contractors in Afghanistan, until 2024 and beyond. Now, I think they want to control the pricing and the flow of natural gas and fossil fuels in the Caspian Sea basin that could believably be sent through that pipeline, not because they want to bring that fuel into our gas tanks here, but because they want to say to China, with whom we're in a Cold War, and Russia, look, we are the ones who will control the price and the flow of resources that your neighboring country may have. So that, I think, has everything to do with the reason transportation routes, both trucking and road routes, and the what's called the TAPI pipeline, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India pipeline, which isn't yet built, but which they have designs on building. And they want to make us think, oh, well, we're in Afghanistan because we have to protect the women and the children. But then why are the women facing starvation? Why does one out of every 11 women die in childbirth? Why does the United Nations say that Afghanistan is the worst country in the world into which a child can be born? 36% unemployment. You can go on and on with the abuses of women living in impoverishment, huddled on the brink of despair. 100 babies froze to death in the harsh winter last winter, and 8 of them in a refugee camp immediately across from a huge, sprawling United States military base.
You take my breath away. So that Unocal pipeline, Unocal is an American company, is it, Kathy?
Yes, it is. It's one that, as we remember, Hamid Karzai had worked for. He was on the board of directors for it. I'm sure there are many other American companies that stand to gain by continued presence in Afghanistan.
So
because the reality here is so many of the jobs in our country are tied into the military.
Oh, I know.
Don't create new jobs.
We'll get into that.
A job creator.
We'll get into that in a second. But that pipeline takes oil from where to where, or it will?
Well, if you go up around the stans, the Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, they border on the Caspian Sea basin area, and it's very, very rich in natural gas and fossil fuels. And so that would be the purposefulness of the pipeline. Then there are also iron ores, coppers, lithiums, rare earth minerals in the ground to be extracted. Now, I don't think environmentally that would be very good for a country that has an agricultural-based economy, and I think would best survive if that could be restored, if the orchards could be reseeded, and if the irrigation systems could be cleaned out, and if the flocks could be replenished. But instead, of course, the profiteers want to go after what might be under the ground. And so they're already thinking, well, how do we truck that through without having the truckers charge enormous sums of money, as they do now, because of paying rents to the warlords that own the roads. So the United States wants ownership of transportation routes and pipelines, and also in relation to Iran, which the United States could feasibly attack in a war, in relationship to Pakistan, which is the only Muslim country that has the nuclear bomb, and which the United States already attacks. I mean, there were 26 Pakistani soldiers killed by United States soldiers, and there was a standoff for 7 months during which the Pakistanis said, you're not crossing our borders, not at Quetta, not at the Khyber Pass, and so all the trucks had to come down through the north. The supplies and the ammunition, the weaponry for the U.S. troops are trucked in. So the United States wants to have a strong military presence without having sprawling military bases necessarily in a country that is adjacent to Pakistan and Iran and also has a border with China and is close to Russia. This is geopolitical. I think it has almost nothing to do with cares and concerns of women and children. Mm. But you can see a PBS public education broadcast where Condoleezza Rice, Hillary Clinton, Madeleine Albright, and U.S. women soldiers in camouflage again and again try to put over on the U.S. public that this is a humanitarian yeah. war. Do you know the soldiers in camouflage, the women soldiers with rifles in their backpacks, are in that same refugee camp I mentioned, cuddling the babies? Good for them to cuddle babies, good for everybody. But why not share some of the supplies they have in a camp where there's no logs, there's no coal, there's no donkey to go get logs or coal. People are starving, literally, and the drones are what drove them to the camp in the first place. Drone attacks with Hellfire missiles.
I'm still speechless. That huge military base adjacent to that huge refugee camp, is that the one in Kabul, the biggest, almost the biggest American military base in the world, Kathy?
Well, no, that will probably be the United States Embassy. It's going to become the largest U.S. embassy in the world, and because of the security attached to it, it really functions as a military base. And the Bagram military base, about an hour and a half beyond Kabul, is a huge military base. There's a huge base at Kandahar. The one that I'm speaking of across from the refugee camp is also a sprawling base, but it's not the biggest.
Now, let's get back to the pipeline. Okay, it goes from the Caspian Sea to where? Across Afghanistan?
Across Pakistan and into India. Now,
India.
Again, it doesn't...
It's going into India. Well, does America think it can come into India and take the oil that's being transported from the Caspian Sea across Afghanistan to India? So then America collects the oil from India?
No. You see, it isn't so much that the Americans want to take the oil and sell it. They want to control the pricing and the flow so that China can't take that oil.
Well, who gets the oil when it gets to India?
Well, if China wants to buy it, then the U.S. will be able to dictate the prices because the U.S. built the pipeline. I mean, actually, the Asia Development Bank built the pipeline, but more than half of the shares belong to the United States.
Is the pipeline completed?
No, it doesn't. It barely exists.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why it's going to be a 10-year process.
Well,
they have to first build, the military presence and try to, as they say, eradicate al-Qaeda. But Leon Panetta was asked how many al-Qaeda figures he thought there were in December of 2010, and he said, about 55.
I know.
We could send an Australian soccer team in there.
It's a total myth. The wickedness is so unbelievable. I've got a pain in my stomach as we talk about it.
But really, it was when I was in Australia as the guest of some of your fine peace activists that I began to understand much more intently that the U.S. military presence in Darwin is part of that ring that they want to build, with the Asia-Pacific Rim being able to affect China. And these drones that we speak of require a satellite component. Now, not every country that wants to have drone policing or drone surveillance or drone warfare has the satellite. China has it, Israel has it, the U.S. has it. But the U.S. would then rent its satellite capacity to other countries that want to engage in this drone surveillance or drone warfare or drone policing. And so there's a huge tie-in with the NATO countries in which the United States is almost in a capacity to blackmail other countries. If you want to be part of the 21st century military, then you better not object to what we demand of you.
Okay, so now let's get down to basics. I want you to explain how the drones work, who the people are who operate them, where they sit, what they're watching, how the whole thing works, Kathy Kelly.
You know, I have to say I was not even paying any attention whatsoever to 21st century military development. And there's a very fine young man, Jeremy Scahill, who wrote the book Blackwater, And he was in our kitchen literally pounding the table saying, when are you all going to get up to speed on the 21st century military? And we were sort of looking blankly. And that's when we started to research MQ-9s and Predators and realized that at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, there was a huge portion of the base dedicated to United States Air Force personnel operating weaponized drones that were flying over Afghanistan. So what's required is an air base, and this one would be in Shamsi in Pakistan, with runways and with security contractors who go into Pakistan and can get the drone, whether it's an MQ-9 Reaper drone or a Predator drone or some other kind of drone. But the weaponized ones can carry 4 Hellfire missiles and 2 500-pound bombs. You get it airborne, right? And then as soon as it lifts off the ground, then it's being controlled by an Air Force person in a dimly lit trailer inside the Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, and now inside numerous bases all across the United States. People are training, and they're also operating these drones over Afghanistan, over Iraq, over Somalia, over Yemen. So a weaponized drone can fly over its target, have the target in the crosshairs, fire the missiles, fly away, and all that the person operating the drone looking at the computer screen will see is a kind of an explosion, dirt and trees flying, body parts flying, and they've been told to follow orders. When the word is impact, that's when they're supposed to pull that joystick and release the Hellfire missiles or the 500-pound bomb. Now, can you imagine somebody who is sitting inside this trailer, gets the order, impact, fires the drone, sees the body parts flying, maybe has been tracking this human being for weeks, seeing where they go to the mosque and where they stop their car to get fuel and where they meet with their children. And then suddenly that person no longer exists, but it's 3 o'clock and that Air Force employee has to get out to his car and go home and pick up his child on the soccer field.
Well, I know, yeah, I've read about this, that these people who, these killers who sit at the consoles directing their missiles from the drones see the body parts, and, you know, it may be a wedding party or it may be a family, and that because most pilots, all pilots, when they drop their bombs, just fly on and don't see the body parts created by their bombs. These people do, and so these people are having to have psychological counseling to deal with their post-traumatic stress syndrome because they keep seeing body parts everywhere that they've created, right?
But of course, there's no such counseling available for Fazila, who is a young widow with a 5-year-old child, Aymal, and her husband was in a garden having tea with 4 other fellow students. And all of a sudden, Hellfire missiles were fired into their garden. They were killed instantly. And Fazila says never would she want to see that kind of carnage, that sorrow, happen to anyone else. But she's utterly bewildered. How can she tell her son that a computer killed her father, his father? And then her mother-in-law, it was just in a white-hot rage, and she said, they don't ask questions. Who was this? What was that? She said that they had gone to the officials, and they said, why? Why did you kill these young men? And they were told there were suspicions. There were doubts.
Suspicion, yep.
There's no right to find out what your crime was. There's no due process. There's no trial. There's no bringing people into for questioning. I mean, I don't agree with interrogation when the tactics are so brutal, and it seems to me the questioning should be directed at the people who every week in the United States join the Oval Office, President Obama and Mr. Harold Coe and Admiral John Brennan. They join together and they go over in a 100-person conference call a list of who should be assassinated that week or this week or next week.
Yeah, so they choose people of suspicion. They kill them and maybe their friends, and then when there's a funeral for the people they've killed, they then kill the people at the funeral, assuming that the young men who go to the funeral, it's usually men, they're involved too, so they kill them too, right, Kathy?
And even rescue workers try to time when they would go to the scene, hoping that maybe the possibility of an attack on the rescuers won't kill them. And it's very hard because sometimes they know that there are people who might survive if they could be pulled out of the rubble or pulled out of the fire. And yet, you know, they've got children and families too. So with all of this gore and carnage and bereavement and loss and injustice and violations of law and the potential proliferation, because this is being done again and again and again, do we think that this is worth building a pipeline so that the United States gets to control the pricing and the flow of oil and other resources? It's a kind of a greed and a sickness that is, I think, growing in alarming proportions, because increasingly the jobs for U.S. people are so tied into what we might call the military-industrial congressional media complex that people are afraid. They're very, very afraid to speak their mind and to say, we don't want this. And so our job is to keep nurturing, with one and two people, with three and ten people, just keep on building the numbers of people who will say, we demand something different. We want jobs that will employ us to make things that are good for people and to do things that are life-giving.
Well, that's a huge job. Kathy, without the agreement and cooperation of the U.S. media, you're nowhere. I mean, as you talk, it occurs to me, I'm coming to America soon. Why don't we make an appointment with the editorial board of the New York Times and go and talk to them?
Sure, I think that's a good idea. And I'm very glad you're coming to the United States, because there's a great deal of respect for what you've done and the consistency and persistence that you've shown. And I think, there was a point when people at the height of the Cold War thought, well, you know, these missiles might go flying, and we should try to put an end to this. And unfortunately, I think we've had a psychic numbing with regard to our nuclear weapons and almost all of our weapons. I suppose, you know, we should certainly always try to influence the mainstream media, but I'm very impressed by the Occupy effort. You know, within 12 weeks, that logo 99 and 1 was globalized. 12 weeks. They did what a number of us have tried, you know, throughout our adult lives. And so I think becoming the media ourselves can also be important, to do what you do, to write and to speak and to, create a radio program. We're fortunate here that we do have some very, very strong alternative media.
Yeah. So let's talk about the proliferation of the drones. And I mean, right from the start, when I first read about them, they were called the Predator and the Reaper, you know, reaping human lives, predating on human lives, just obscene. And the man who partly builds them is at General Atomics, called, he's a man called Blue, and he now owns a uranium mine in Australia called the Beverly Uranium Mine. But there's now a huge demand for drones, is there not, Kathy? And I don't know how many America owns now, but it's a new type of warfare. And I remember reading about it initially, and they said, look, it's great, the think tanks in Washington, you know, those young men with great left brains, very hypertrophied left brains, running around telling everyone how they should think and behave, that it's all great because we can now fight wars and kill people, but we won't get killed ourselves. I mean, that was the ultimate height of immorality. It just took my breath away to read how they were thinking.
Well, I think the word that we should always put before people is proliferation, because, you know, there will be people who will say, well, what do you want, carpet bombing? Do you want people to drop 500
we've got to stop. No,
villages.
We've got to stop killing. We've got to stop killing. Yeah.
And stop basing foreign policy on menacing and threatening and forcing. And how do people threaten and force other people? They say, we'll kill you if you don't do
exactly
what we're demanding that you do. But I think that I don't want U.S. people or Australian people to act out of fear either. We want people to act because they are impassioned by belief that we can mm-hmm. do a far, far better job. But the reality still remains that Israel is selling drone aircraft to China. China is selling them to other countries that trade with China. I suppose that includes Pakistan, which is their neighboring country. It's become like the Lady Gaga of the industry. And what are the universities being paid to research? Not how to retrofit the housing stock or build high-speed, you know, mass transit systems, but how to make more and more variations of these drones so that you can get ones that are so tiny they can go in the windows and up and down staircases. You can get drones now that can be so capable of surveillance that they can hover over a certain area for as long as 48 hours. And so this capacity combined with the Special Operations Forces is a kind of a new means of warfare that many other countries will want to adopt because, you know, they might not be able to afford big, huge military bases, but they can afford a dimly lit trailer and some highly trained special operations type warriors. And this will come back. It will come back to roost in capacity of other people to attack the United States as well.
Well, it would be easy enough, really, thinking about it, you know, and extrapolating from what you said, that some country could put a drone overhead and kill the president because you can see him. I mean, I know people get searched whenever he addresses a big gathering of people. Everyone gets searched for guns and the like. But you see, from a drone up in the air, which may not almost be visible to people, could see the president and target him. I mean, that's a natural extrapolation of what you're saying, is it not, Kathy?
And this is what's so inscrutable to me. There are spiking rates of death threats made for President Obama, and he's always at the risk of assassination. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we must hope and work for a moral tone in this country that would lower the likelihood of assassination ever being used, because it's a despicable tactic. But it's hard to do when, you know, our foreign policy is endorsing assassination. And so I really think we have to turn to international law and to the United Nations. The Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Killings for the United Nations has said this is in violation of laws that already exist. And, you know, we thought the United States sort of is signed on to the UN Charter and would be respectful, but it doesn't seem to hold water. I mean, technically, if a pilot is given orders by a general, this is a pilot flying in a regular plane in the cockpit, to bomb a target, the pilot is duty-bound under international law to verify that target is not a civilian. Well, with the drones, that's simply not even a question. There was a three-vehicle convoy traveling from the Dikundi province of Afghanistan, and it was probably the trip of a lifetime for the passengers, and they were mostly grandmothers and mothers and infants, and some of those women, you know, they never leave their village hardly ever in the course of a year, but they were going for medical care in Kabul and to the huge market in Kandahar, so they had to pass through the Uruzgan province, and how could they know that not so far away reconnaissance fighters from the United States had been dropped out of an airplane and parachuted down. And the drones were monitoring the area to make sure there would never be any attack on those secret reconnaissance fighters. And then along comes this convoy of cars along a mountain road, so there had to be a quick decision made, and the kill chain was invoked, and the emails and the messages were flying. Is this or is this not a hostile convoy? And finally, the decision of the kill chain was, well, we can't take the risk. And so the first car was blown up. And there was one drone operator who had figured out that he could make out a grandmother and an infant in one of the cars. So he knew it was civilian. And he was trying to get his message to the top of the kill chain, but he couldn't do it. And so after the first car was blown up, the women in the second car jumped out and they waved their long scarves and they shouted, "Civilians!" And to no avail, the third car was spared.
Oh, my God.
And do you know, Helen, there are 65,000 to 70,000 analysts working for the United States Air Force to analyze the surveillance footage. It would amount to 58,000 full-length feature films that's acquired as the drones fly over Afghanistan. And their mandate is to establish patterns of life in Afghanistan. And I want to say, if you want to see patterns of life, come with me and I'll introduce you to the Afghan peace volunteers, and they'll talk to you about their families. And these are young people that have had their own relatives, fathers and brothers, killed by Taliban fighters, by Hazara fighters. And they say, we don't want revenge. We don't want retaliation. We want to live without wars. Let that voice be heard. But when we tried to bring two of them, teenagers, over here just for 10 days, the visas were turned down.
I just, every time you make a statement, I'm speechless. That, you know, I wrote a book called War in Heaven with Craig Eisendrath about America arming space and fighting war from space down to Earth. But, of course, this is war in heaven as well. It's war in heaven because the satellites are in heaven watching everything and killing people from heaven. That's what's happening.
And we really must do everything we can to connect the dots. And our scientists are so needed and our medical personnel. If I could mention again, the coordinator for these Afghan peace volunteers is an MD, a medical doctor from Singapore. Very, very bright, multilingual, committed, has lived in the area for now 9 years. What they are coordinating, it would be so great if you could join them, is a December 10th gathering in Kabul on International Human Rights Day. They want to seek 2 million friends. 2 million people have been killed over these four decades of war in Afghanistan. And they're saying, let us seek 2 million friends and commemorate those who've died, but try to replace them with 2 million friends rather than go for revenge and retaliation. And they're asking the United Nations to please negotiate a ceasefire among all the warring parties, among the 49 NATO countries that are in Afghanistan, and the Taliban warlords, and the drug lords, and the many, many people that profiteer, the proxy wars fought by neighboring countries. If the UN could try to do that and had support from people all around the world, that's what they envision. And Mairead McGuire and retired Colonel Anne Wright, John Deere, other personages with Dr. Seema Samar, will gather together in Kabul. And Seema Samar is a brilliant pediatrician who has worked very hard with the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission. So these kinds of actions give me a great deal of hope. 65% of Afghanistan's population are under 18 years of age, according to AusAid, Australian Aid. So it's a very young country, and maybe they can envision a different way.
So 2 million Afghanis have been killed in the last four decades? 2 million?
Yes. The invasions.
It's a Holocaust.
And you don't really hear so much about
it. It's 2 million, is it, Kathy?
Travesty. Yes, that's true. The Soviet invasion, invasions and fighting and internecine warfare, the cruelty, and particularly as it's borne by people who often live in small villages. I was with young women in the Bamyan province, lovely young women, and I asked them, well, did you ever hear of a day when airplanes flew into tall buildings in my country and there were many people killed? And they looked at me as though, you know, she seemed like such a nice person. Why is she telling these strange stories? They'd never heard of 9/11.
Why would they? When
right.
2 million people have been killed. And isn't it one of the poorest countries on earth, Kathy Kelly?
Yes, it is certainly one of the poorest countries on earth. The systems that had been functioning were agricultural systems, and they've just been decimated.
Mm.
And so, Hakim, the medical doctor, his name is Dr. Wee, but he's been called Hakim as a sign of respect in the Dari language. He went for an entire year with two servings of fruit himself. the availability of fruits and vegetables to people is very much contingent on the seasons. And now with the sanctions against Iran, the price of wheat has gone up 60%, because, you see, the fuel costs more for transporting the wheat. And so families that can't feed their families already have nothing that would enable them to handle a 60% increase in fuel prices. So the seamstresses come to where the Afghan peace volunteers live every day now, and they managed to get 8 sewing machines and to say to women, you know, we'll get the fabric and the patterns and the markers and the scissors. Please come and try to make things, and then maybe you'll have some way to feed your family. And they're trying to go to school and learn, become literate themselves.
I don't really get what Obama's thinking. What the hell is he thinking? Because, you know, he is an intelligent man, and he seems to care about, you know, eradicating nuclear weapons in the world. And he did set up a partial, if flawed, healthcare system for America. But what the hell is he thinking he's doing in Afghanistan? Or doesn't he understand? Or hasn't he been properly briefed? I mean, what do you think, Kathy?
Well, I think that as would be probably true of almost any president of the United States while they're in office, and he beforehand, he's a centrist and a militarist. I have a great deal of respect for how thoughtful he is, and, that's more than we can say for the previous president. But nevertheless, he's a centrist and a militarist. He's the commander-in-chief of a country that has purchased more weapons than the next 18 weapon-purchasing countries combined. We shouldn't fool ourselves. Those of us who'd been in Iraq breaking the economic sanctions and then during the shock and awe bombing, we tried hard to stop the ongoing supplemental spending bills that funded the war in Iraq, the ongoing war. And we thought for sure that as a senator, he would vote against those supplemental spending bills, but he didn't. He voted for every single one except for the last, right before he was running for president, and he just was in absentia during that vote. And when he was on the campaign trail, he called Iraq a dumb war, but he assured people that Afghanistan would be the war that he would wage. Now, I think that he was treated unfairly when General McChrystal leaked information saying that you would have to have at least 40,000 soldiers to have an effective surge. That somewhat tied his hands, and maybe that's why he went for the 30,000. And I bring that up because when people think that Bradley Manning made leaks that were dangerous, the most dangerous leak, the one that has cost lives and limbs and destruction and will continue to wreak havoc because of the weapons that are littering the ground and because of the post-traumatic stress and because of the killing that goes on every single day, that was under General McChrystal's leakage of information that forced this country to move toward a surge. It could have been ended.
So I want to get on to you. Well, you told me you were a teacher in Chicago and used to teach the children about peace and stuff. How did you get involved on this journey, Kathy Kelly?
Well, I was teaching in a Jesuit college prep school when I was showing your films. The students really responded, by the way, to that Physicians for Social Responsibility film because they wanted to be medical people. They wanted to be doctors. And here was a doctor telling them that there were no communist children, there were no capitalist children, there were just children. And it was the height of the Cold War. And they'd go home and tell their parents about it, and then I'd be in a whole world of trouble. I couldn't any longer talk about the preferential option for the poor and continue to take a salary and, pay taxes into that system. So I became a war tax refuser, and I have been since 1980. I'm happy about that. I've successfully refused all forms of federal income tax since 1980. So the IRS sort of becomes like my spiritual director. And I liked the job at the Jesuit College Prep School, but I also realized that I shouldn't be teaching rich people's children. I should be teaching the children of the impoverished. And so I started in an alternative school teaching two different gangs in my own neighborhood. And we plan more funerals than graduations every year, and I just couldn't keep on going as though that was normal. So now this is where logic ends. I can't give you an A to B, but we decided, a number of us in what I could kind of affectionately call the do-gooders ghetto in this desperately poor neighborhood, that we would plant corn on top of nuclear weapons that were buried under the ground. And so we did that. We planted a lot of corn that summer. As soon as they let us go, we went right out and did it again. We'd be arrested. We'd be told, okay, if you do this again, you're going to be arrested, and we're not going to let you go. And I was thinking, well, good, please don't, because if we keep on going out like we said we will, we'll face so many years in prison, we won't see the light of day. As it turned out, I had a judge who, I could have been sentenced to 30 months in prison, and he only gave me a year. So I did a year in maximum security prison for planting corn on nuclear missile silo sites. In fact, a mistake was perhaps made. I was let out after 9 months.
What was it like in jail in a maximum security prison in America?
Well, before I taught at the Jesuit school, I taught in Catholic girls' high school, so in a way I was ready.
Oh, my God!
You know, no talking in the hallways, and where's your uniform, and where's your pass, and it's frustrating, there's no doubt. And for the women who feel enormous stigma and guilt and are separated from their children, I can't begin to describe the sorrow. I met such bravery. I'd never met the Bad Sisters. I don't know where they were. I've been in maximum security, minimum security. I must have been arrested, 60, 80 times. I've lost count. But I've not met the Bad Sisters. What I've met is a criminal, so-called criminal justice system that is so wrong-headed and so cruel. Women are sentenced routinely to 8 to 15 years for nonviolent crimes, mostly drug-related.
Oh my God.
And the last time I was in a minimum security prison, it was a camp across from a medium to high security prison, and the median sentence length for the men in that prison was 27 years.
Oh, my God.
So you'd watch these young men shuffling off the bus, their ankles chained, their wrists chained, their ankles and wrists chained together and chained to the next prisoner, and you know, they're stumbling, trying to get off the bus, and they will be grandfathers before they leave that prison.
And aren't these prisons set up as really slave camps for the multinational corporations where lots of stuff is made very cheaply or free with slave labor?
And also weapons are made for the United States.
Weapons are made in the prisons?
Yes, there are weapon components that are made in the prisons. And right now we speak not only of the military, industrial, media, congressional complex, but also the prison industrial security complex, and that's where the jobs are. And this is why it's so, so hard to change it. We have a declining number of jobs available, and people are afraid that they won't be able to take care of their children if they protest on behalf of other people's children in other lands. And so this is what we must try to do. It's a major, major, major education task. And I think one of the ways to do it, one way, is to go into the prisons as a prisoner and really understand the war against the poor in our own country, which will certainly affect rising numbers of people.
Are you a Catholic, Kathy?
Well, I sure like the nuns. You know, people ask, where's the leadership in the Catholic Church? And I say, look to what these religious women are doing.
But you
They're brilliant in their PR. But I think that if a group takes ideas that are speculative and turns it into dogma and then says, my dogma is better than yours, and for that reason I have a right to kill you or discriminate against you, whether it's any religious grouping, I want to stand back and say, hang on, let's question that. I think nonviolence can change the world. I think the most impoverished in our world should always be the number one priority, and I think it's a gift to be able to live simply and share resources. And you can find much teaching about that in the life of Jesus.
Yeah,
and I want
well, that's
to do
what
that.
He used to say. Leave your good worldly goods and follow me.
But I'm not so interested in hierarchies and institutions or maintenance that's given priority over mission. I think that the mission is to make sure that the hungry are fed, especially the children.
Yeah. Well, Kathy, we've come to the end of our time now. What a fascinating, depressing, and exhilarating interview you've given. You give us light and hope, I think, and inspiration. We all should become Kathy Kellys or Joan of Arcs and get on our metaphorical white chargers and charge off and do the right thing. I mean, we're not here to make ourselves happy. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the only happiness you can get is serving others. That's the only key and source of happiness is serving others, and you do that. That's what you're doing with your whole life, right?
Well, it's so good to think of Joan of Arc. I mean, she was a militarist, too, and a curious, curious genius. But she apparently is reputed to have said, if we go before the good God with just ourselves, we'll be asked, where are the others? And I think that's part of our charge, to serve, but always to try to see the humanity in other people and to see ourselves as we're seen by other people. That was the message that the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King gave us. So thank you, Helen, for this amazing time to be with you. I can't wait to meet you.
Well, maybe we can go to the New York Times together. We'll email each other, okay, Kathy?
All right, thank you.
Thank you very, very, very much. Bye.
Bye now.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Kathy Kelly, a peace activist and a member of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, a group based in Chicago. Kathy served 9 months in a maximum security prison in the US for planting corn on nuclear missile silos. As a war tax refuser, she has avoided payment of all forms of federal income tax since 1980. Good on you, Kathy! Go to her website at www.vcnv.org. Thanks for listening, everyone, to today's very inspiring interview. And we'll be back with you again next week with another inspiring interview. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.